I have been out and about for, essential things like going out grocery shopping or getting gasoline, and myself have been yelled at, or have had people drive by and yell racial slurs, and it's just been really terrifying. And to me, what was really interesting is people were around me and they heard this and they said nothing.
From UW Tacoma, this is Pod Defiance.
Welcome to Pod Defiance, where we don't lecture, but we do educate. I'm your host, Eric Wilson Edge, sitting in today for Sarah Smith. Today on the pod, racism and COVID-19. For this episode, we talked with students, faculty, and staff at UW Tacoma to get their perspectives on racist insults and attacks targeting Asian Americans. Rachel Indo, the Dean of UW Tacoma's School of Education, helps put what we're seeing now into a larger historical perspective. Staff psychologist and avid runner Paolo Laragno discusses racism he's experienced while out for a jog. He also discusses the murder of fellow runner Ahmaud Arbery. Finally, UW Tacoma students Melissa Atienza and Joseph Daynot provide insight into their everyday experiences as Asian Americans. Before we start, I want to acknowledge recent events, including the death of George Floyd in Minnesota, Emmanuel Ellis here in Tacoma. The recordings for this episode took place a few weeks ago, and putting them together took a while. Please know that we will produce at least one episode, and likely more, about racism experienced by Black men and women in this country. These are important issues, and we are working out how best to discuss them and who we need to include in the conversation. Thank you. Dr. Rachel Indo, thank you for joining us today on Pod Defiance.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric.
Before we get started with the meat of our interview, why don't you just tell us a little bit about what you do here at UW-Tacoma?
Well, I am currently serving as Dean of the School of Education, and so it is a great school. We have programs in teacher certification, principal preparation. We have an EdD and a master's for practicing educators, and also soon to be launching a new school psychology and undergraduate program. So my main job is to just advocate for faculty, staff, programs, and our students in the school.
So I wonder if we could start, if you could talk about racism in your own life and how that's manifested.
Well, the short answer of that is that when I really reflect on it, racism has just been a part of my everyday life since I was born. But whether I was aware of that or not really didn't come until I was in college. And so long story short was I was born and raised in Nebraska and attended Nebraska public schools, and I had all white teachers, and there weren't a lot of people who looked like me, and so I didn't learn much about my own experiences or history. And it was only when I went to college did I take courses on diversity and multiculturalism, where I really started to learn about what racism actually is, including individual racism, institutional racism, and how that impacted Asian Americans and other racialized communities in the United States. But when you ask about my experiences with racism, it's so vast and common and every day that I'll just maybe talk about a few themes that have cut across my life. And so as you alluded to earlier, Asian Americans are viewed as these perpetual foreigners that, and this has been going back for centuries, where the West has viewed Asians as either exotic foreigners or that we're dirty and we're always, inciting violence and chaos, that we spread diseases. And so this type of rhetoric has been around for centuries. And in the United States, especially since, if we go back a while, in 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act. And so when I am asked questions like, where are you really from? It's really interesting because when I tell people, oh yeah, I was born and raised in Omaha, Nebraska, they're not satisfied with that. And they'll say, well, where are you really from? And they'll ask me again and again. And as a kid, that was really confusing to me. But I learned later that this is connected to a long history of anti-Asian sentiment, where we were actually legally barred from citizenship until the early 1950s, and then more recently on a wide scale version in 1965 with the Hart-Keller Act, which led to a mass migration of Asian immigrants. So this notion of being not American, having to defend my existence in this country. And so it's really weird because, again, I was born and raised in Nebraska. I'm American, but yet I can't even call my country my own because many of our neighbors and citizens don't view me or other Asian Americans as Americans. Another theme of racism is around invisibility and erasure. So when we look at conversations around diversity in the U.S., it's still framed in a very black-white racial binary. So Asian Americans are often left out. Or when we're included, we're often used as a way to, it's called the model minority stereotype. So the notion that Asian Americans, that we're well-behaved, we're doing so well, and that we want to be like whites. And often that's used to pit us against other people of color and to diminish their experiences with racism, but also in a way that, again, makes us invisible. So even though we've been here for many generations, we're not really even acknowledged within conversations around diversity, which can be very dangerous. And finally, I would say, and this is something that even impacts me now, is this notion of always being questioned and scrutinized. So as one example that's current, you might know, Eric, that UW-Tacoma is 30 years young or old, depending on how you frame it. But I'm the first and only Asian American woman to be a chief academic officer on this campus. But yet our students, we have at least 20% Asian Pacific American students, and we have many more in our community, surrounding communities, who are Asian and Asian American. And so what this means is that it's just me, right? As in leadership meetings, and often the only voice for issues around equity and racial justice. But again, it's not just me in this body and how I appear in the world, but it's also my my politics, my ideology. So I also identify as someone who really wants to push the envelope and insist on equity and racial justice. But those types of conversations are often muted because people wonder why I even care about these issues. But for me, it really is about right, Asian Americans and other marginalized communities, we experience vast levels of institutional as well as individual oppression and prejudice. And so someone has to raise those issues. But again, it's always around of why do you care about these issues? Or often it's very much based on stereotypes like, well, you're supposed to be the quiet and subservient Asian American, so just keep your mouth shut and don't really question the status quo. But for me, that's just not who I am and what I think is in the best interest of our community. So I think speaking up can also be something that many Asian Americans find. We find ourselves being silenced or diminished. So again, those are just a few examples of racism. Again, it's been part of my everyday life, and I know for many other Asian Americans as well.
I wonder, how has your response to that question, where are you from? I wonder, how has that changed over time as you've grown up and you've gone to college and you've accomplished these degrees, like these really impressive like degrees, you have a PhD. How has your response changed to that question?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So when I was a kid or a young person, I didn't know what to say because I wasn't sure where that was coming from. But after I learned more about, right, there's millions of other people who look like me in the United States who are experiencing the same types of questions, my response has changed to one of, often I will ask the person what they really mean by what they're asking, and they'll just say, well, and often they can critically reflect and correct themselves. But my response has been one from initially just frustration, like, why do I have to explain who I am? I was born here and I'm an American citizen, to one of a teachable moment, and I can just ask the person about where they're coming from, and then trying to use that as a teachable moment to explain a little bit more about why that's really problematic, especially not just for Asian Americans, but also for many Latinx individuals as well. We have similar types of experiences being seen as foreigners, so really kind of stepping in and interrupting those moments, but gently and with care and love for the person who's making the question with the set of assumptions associated with it.
So you authored a book that I think that's geared towards high school teachers that looks at the Japanese American experience during World War II. I'm curious, what led you to want to write that particular book?
For me, I think the major motivation was, you know, as I mentioned, I've been educated in Nebraska public schools and they're learning nothing about Asian American, let alone Japanese American history till college, to me was extremely problematic. But as I started to learn more about how this has been actually more prevalently taught in middle and secondary schools in the West Coast, I started to look at different curriculum, children's books, lesson plans, and much of it was really good stuff, especially a lot of the primary sources written by Japanese American authors themselves. But a lot of the mainstream curriculum was extremely problematic for a few reasons. One is they were not written by Japanese Americans or people who extensively understand our lived experiences and all the complexities. Another reason was that it was promoting certain mainstream narratives that we were, again, like the quiet minority who obediently went to the camps and then never, right, challenged the government's decision and then assimilated and integrated with white Americans after the war. And that's not true. There are a lot of Japanese Americans who immediately challenged the constitutionality of the incarceration. There were draft resistors. There was a lot of hidden narratives of resistance and opposition to the treatment of Japanese Americans that we don't see in mainstream textbooks. So for this particular guide, the National Council of Teachers of English, they have a high school literature series directed toward high school teachers. And so I thought, all right, what would be really important information to share that gives the right amount of historical context, that gives a balanced portrait of the Japanese American experience during World War II, as well as just some of the cultural context and references, as well as connections to other Asian Americans in racialized groups, because another issue with a lot of the curriculum on the World War II experience of Japanese Americans is it focuses primarily on Japanese Americans in relation to whites. But as the book portrays, we've had many connections with American Indians, with African Americans, Latinx population. So it's really important for people to kind of see a more nuanced view and hoping that many high school teachers, and again, the curriculum is not very robust, or there's not just a lot of available curriculum that's also concise. So the hope is that this work could help teachers of English or teachers of actually any grade level or background have some helpful information that they can implement in the classroom so they can teach about the World War II incarceration and other historical events and just the culturally sensitive and also in a contextualized way. So you're not just like reading a book and responding to it, but you're reading the book and you know for what to look for in terms of certain signals, historical cues and context, and also connections to kids and their own lived experiences and identity. There's a lot of universal experiences that can be pulled from any type of people's experiences as well.
I remember recently seeing people who are protesting like stay-at-home orders. There is this narrative I'm seeing now of people who are comparing it to the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, saying that, you know, it's the argument is that government is intruding on freedoms, and if we weren't okay with that, like if we look back now and say, well, we didn't like what happened then, right? But then why would we be happy with this? I'm just curious about what your take on that argument is.
I did see that article, I think it was yesterday, and I think that Densho, which is a Japanese American nonprofit, wrote a really good response to that. But I'll just kind of summarize what I think my initial response is that with the pandemic, right, this is a health and safety issue impacting all of us. And so the stay-at-home order is really inconvenient and challenging for many of us, but it is for everyone's health and protection versus during World War II, Japanese Americans were racially profiled and they were forcibly removed and then from their homes, right, without due process and without any legal protections, and then were removed en masse into concentration camps. They weren't even able to stay in their own homes, right? So there's many reasons why that argument is not just confusing and weird, but also just very insensitive and also disrespectful to Japanese Americans and their families who were incarcerated during World War II. But again, I know that where that's probably coming from is, right, just the frustration. We're all under quarantine and it's very difficult. But again, those types of references are really problematic. And also even hearing comparisons about how our COVID-19 response should be like how we responded, right, to the Pearl Harbor attack or 9/11. So those types of references are, again, extremely problematic because they're just false equivalents and can fuel certain types of narratives that are really dangerous and that have racialized undertones.
I wonder, is there a connection historically between like moments of crisis like we're in now and sort of a rise in sort of racism? Is that something we've seen? I mean, World War II, that seems like an obvious one, but is that like a reoccurring theme in American history?
Oh, absolutely. So if you tuned into the screening of Asian Americans yesterday with KBTC, Dr. Nikki Filler from Highline gave a really just beautiful response to a similar type of question. And she basically said, right, whenever there's a moment of economic downturn, wartime hysteria, that it's a time where often people of color are scapegoated, right, that we are seen as, right, taking away jobs from whites, spreading disease, inciting violence. And so I would say absolutely there's many connections to crisis and a rise of racism. So another example that, a couple more examples that are more recent include, in the contemporary times, post-civil rights is the murder of Vincent Chin in 1982. And that was a time where there was a lot of hysteria against Japan's economic rise. And so we saw a lot of resentment and there was some, just a lot of American workers who were unemployed. And so they were scapegoating the Japanese. And what happened with Vincent Chin, you might have heard about this, he was Chinese American and they thought he was Japanese. And so a white father and a stepson brutally beat him with a baseball bat. And it was really something that was unfortunate. But again, it was tied to these economic anxieties. And so, of course, I would say that it's not just with Asian Americans, but with other groups as well, right? We see, and interestingly, with the pandemic, for a lot of undocumented immigrants, especially from Central America as well, now suddenly, right, there's a shortage of the meat supply or agriculture or a lot of the service industries. And so, but yet, you know, we see a shift in terms of they're still being targeted for deportation. And we see a lot of this moral panic against racialized bodies in these times. And again, when we look back in history, there's moments of this from the formation of the Union where, again, just the rise of racism in times of economic downturns and especially wartime and things of the like.
In moments like this and in moments, reoccurring moments over our U.S. history, is this rise in sort of racism, is it? It's tied to anxiety of some kind, but is it because there lacks like a coherent like policy from like a federal or state government to alleviate the issues behind it? Like if you're worried about, you know, in the 80s, Japan overtaking market share and maybe losing jobs, like it seems like in my mind, to address the actual economic anxiety, you figure out some way to bring those jobs back or create new jobs for people. So is it an absence of policy that allows this sort of hatred to sort of fill the void?
Ooh, that's a great question. I do think that is correct, right? And I would even go further to say that, and again, with economic policy, it's complicated. As long as we live in a capitalistic society where, right, the bottom lines and profits and efficiencies. And we as consumers too are complicit in this, right? We want a TV for the lowest price, or we want any type of commodity for the lowest price. So we're all participating and perpetuating this type of system. But that aside, I might even bring it back to your question around policy. And what I would say is, in addition to economic policy, I just think there's some things that even go before that. One is around how to report hate crimes. And as you might be aware, the current presidential administration has rolled back a lot of the protections from prior years. And so it makes it harder just to even how we define and document and also penalize people who perpetuate and participate in hate crimes against different groups. That's more difficult. And even in terms of educational policy, right? What do we teach or not in the curriculum? And so, for example, in some states, there's been a rollback of efforts to include multicultural and ethnic studies, right? And so that's also problematic because in the absence of learning more about people and our right identities and histories, then that can fuel a lot of ignorance. And then I think also perpetuates a lot of problematic stereotypes. But like you said, it is a complex issue and one where I think too that just the, you know, and again, like you said, just right, violently smashing and breaking a device. I mean, that's also concerning because it's not just fear, but fear turning into violence and hatred. And as we saw with Vincent Chin, it took his life, right? So it's scary. It's absolutely terrifying when you really think about it.
So I wonder, where does the responsibility lie? And I want to frame this question in terms of where we are right now to check sort of this behavior. Is it, do we look to sort of our national leaders or our state leaders, or is it up to, you know, each individual person to try and address this? Is it a combination of all three? I mean, how do we check this sort of behavior and say that it's not appropriate or welcomed?
Great question. And it is everyone's responsibility. It's everyone's moral and social responsibility. But let me break that down a little bit. So it does come from the top, and whether that is our national and world leaders or institutional or organizational leaders, right? Leaders have to take a stand and they have to be very firm in their convictions and to basically stay and make statements that hate will not be tolerated, or as incidents or crises come, to directly address it. The worst thing to do is just to remain silent, right? To remain silent means basically you're consenting to some words or behaviors that are undesirable or problematic. So it does need to come from leadership, and leaders need to model the course of action and also just reminding people about the power of language. But as you mentioned too, individual responsibilities. So I have been out and about for, you know, essential things like going out grocery shopping or getting gasoline, and myself have been yelled at or have had people drive by and yell racial slurs, and it's just been really terrifying. And to me, what was really interesting is people were around me and they heard this and they said nothing. Now, whenever I hear anything that's inappropriate, whether it's blatant or even more subtle but also really problematic, I have to step in. And so I would say that, yes, individuals who say they care about equity and social justice, you do have to step in. And it might be really uncomfortable because you don't know what to say or how to interrupt the moment. But for me, we as individuals do need to step in. We're all teachers, and we all need to have those conversations, whether it's with our neighbors and own family and loved ones and friends, or whether it's with a stranger. And I think that the way to go about it from any level is one of compassion and love. It can be really easy to get frustrated and show anger in these moments. But again, for me at least, I don't want to put that energy, that negative, hateful energy and violent language back into the world. So it could even be a matter of saying, I need to talk to you about what was just said that was really hurtful. Or if it's a stranger, just to say, I need to interrupt here. But again, being mindful of, right, how we approach that. So it's everyone's responsibility, and we all are in it together. And think about it this way. It's not just really about Asian Americans or racialized identities. Anyone who witnesses anything that's inappropriate, we just can't be bystanders, right? Our you know, like Obama said, we rise together or we fall together. And so I always keep that in mind when these types of moments come.
In those moments when you are sort of witness to something like that, maybe you've just done it for so long that it you don't have to think about it. But I wonder, is there a moment of fear or hesitation on your part? And if so, like, how do you sort of push past that? You know, because I think in the example you mentioned where, you know, someone was yelling stuff at you and, you know, if that person was driving away, you may not be able to say anything to that person, but you could, you know, reach over to you and say, hey, are you okay? Like that seems way less threatening, right? Than if someone's yelling some horrible thing, be like, hey, you stop it, you know, because that person could stop the car and get out and, right? You don't know how that's going to go. But yeah, I'm just curious how you know, I've known you for a little while and it does not surprise me that you, will step in there and say what needs to be said, but is it easy for you? Like, how do you do it?
Well, thank you for the compliment. I would say that it never is easy. And interestingly, I have to say that my parents have always been outspoken because they just said that if you don't speak up, then others will speak for you, right? Or you'll be silenced, but also to pick your battles wisely. And as you said, sometimes there's safety issues. Like, for example, anytime I have to interrupt something, I worry about my safety, whether that is being physically attacked or having someone, right, yell at me. But again, a life is a risk. And that's in any moment, even in moments where we're going about our day and not even thinking about issues, right? We're always kind of walking a fine line. We don't know, right, what will come to us at any moment. But with that said, I think that, like you said, if we are witnessing something, like you said, I really appreciate what you said, even if, right, there's a car and the drivers drive away, people can go up to someone and say, are you okay? If it's a confrontation like what happened here in downtown Tacoma where I live, where people are walking, right? Again, I think a lot of it is, you know, interrupting it, but being very calm, right? Looking the person in the eye. And sometimes even I remember when one of my friends, my African-American friends in Minnesota, there was just this verbal, ugly, racist and racial slurs at the Starbucks. And I just asked the woman, I says, what are you saying, right? And she was just so angry. And I just offered to get her a cup of coffee. It's just like, are you okay? And it turns out she wasn't. She was just having a really bad day. And it doesn't excuse the behavior, but I think a lot of times trying to de-escalate situations, because often when people say and do hurtful things, it's a sign of something going on in their lives. Maybe they lost their job or they lost a loved one. And so trying to diffuse those situations is really important. And I would say, too, that for those of us who are from different minoritized backgrounds, when something happens to us as individuals or people who look like us or really anyone, right, remember it could happen to you. And how would you want others to step in and support you? And so I think the golden rule is always really important when we think about stepping in, even if it's really uncomfortable.
And I am sorry that nobody came to check on you. That is sad in a lot of ways. Do you ever get used to that sort of thing? Like someone, you know, yelling something at you or maybe, I don't know if they even try to like physically accost you. Like, do you ever get used to that sort of thing? Like, do you get to a point where it just sort of rolls off your back, or does it every time you hear that sort of like, you know, just one more little like wound? I mean, I don't know. What does that look like for you?
Well, it truly is, right? Trauma accumulates. So even micro moments, and even if you have a lot of experience being racialized or discriminated against, and this is for anyone, right? You get used to it because there's certain patterns that are predictable, but it doesn't make it any easier to deal with, right? It's not like, right, riding a bike where the more you practice and get used to it, it just right becomes familiar and it's just something you don't think about anymore, but it's just much more deep and traumatizing. But at the same time, it's just one of the things where I know that we're living in a very politicized time where a lot of lives are in danger and where a lot of people are under attack. So I also know that for some people, right, there's just kind of these blinders. And I get that. I just need to survive and think about myself. I don't need or want to think about other people's problems. And I'm just going to go about day to day, hour by hour. So I also understand that too, right? And especially when we're talking about strangers, people we don't know, what does that really mean? But again, it shouldn't be about ourselves. But again, it's about our collective well-being and our collective consciousness and our collective future. So that's how I view it.
What role do people like myself play in situations like this, or maybe just in the world at large? Like, I am a white, heterosexual, middle-class male, right? In a lot of ways, whether I wanted the world to be made for me, it was essentially created for me by people who looked like me or who were kind of looked like me, but were made a lot more money. So what, right? You know, that's not to say that my life is super easy. Every life has challenges, but I think that I've become wise enough to understand that I do have certain advantages in life. Again, that I didn't necessarily ask for, but are given to me just sort of arbitrarily. And so I feel there's some responsibility to do something with that. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, what do I do with it? Or if there's people like me, there's a lot of people like me, like what do we do? Like, when we recognize a system is unjust and, unfair, you know, how do we go about sort of unwinding that? So, small question, easy stuff.
Well,
no worries.
Well, Eric, I do have to say that just even as you framed it is so significant, right? Just reflecting on your own identity and positionality, right? And how you're situated in our society and world. And I think for many white Americans, they just are either unable or unwilling to even go there. And so what you just did modeled what is really important in this world is just that critical reflection. And also thinking about ways to do big and small things to start to change the system. So I really do appreciate that, because that shows a level of consciousness that's really needed in the moment. And I would say too that for our white allies and advocates, it's really helpful, right, to not only step in when you see something wrong or you hear something that doesn't sound right, but also just to be in it with us, right? To be in the world and having teachable moments with different folks. So whether that is just talking to a neighbor and sharing a little bit more about what you might have learned today, or you might have read a book and you can start a critical conversation about race. All of these things are really important. And then sometimes what it means is that in certain spaces, you might, right, be among other white folks and you have a lot of social capital in these spaces to speak up. So for example, in a lot of leadership meetings, not just at UW-Tacoma, but throughout my career, I'm the only Asian American or racialized body in a room. And so when I speak up, often what happens is people will pretend they won't hear me, or they'll try to sideline the conversation. And what's been really helpful is when I have a white ally or an advocate jump in and say, wait a minute, Rachel just said something and we need to address it, right? Because often it's about issues around equity and social justice, and it's really uncomfortable, and you can just see people freeze or kind of not make eye contact or try to stonewall something, and someone can just, particularly white men and women and other folks on the gender binary can step in, and that's really helpful because, again, whether we like it or not, that's, white folks tend to listen to white folks more than others. And so again, even as you know, right, it's not like I'm quiet. I use my adult voice and people can hear me, but sometimes, they might hear that I'm saying something, but they're not listening. And so that's where I see great possibilities to just, with hopes that folks are willing to step up like that. And again, it's hard. There's a lot of risks involved with that. But when we think about the power and possibility of really moving the needle forward in important ways, that's where it can be really helpful.
So my last question is, what is the role of education in addressing racism? What role does it play in maybe informing just sort of knowledge of history or providing context? Yeah, I'm just curious.
Absolutely. So education is really powerful. And the way I describe it is what is actually taught in the curriculum or in the classroom is also one thing, but also what is not taught, we call it the null curriculum, is also really powerful, because what we don't teach about basically also says what we value or don't value. So in terms of the role of education in addressing racism, again, and this was before the pandemic, but kids spend more time in schools than with their loved ones right at home. So a lot of time is invested with kids going to school and being socialized. And it's not just about learning content, but it's about learning how to interact with others and learning about their own place in the world. And so I think that education can be really powerful in a couple of ways. One is around the curriculum. So making sure that all kids have access to seeing themselves in the curriculum, but also learning about others. And this is across the board, irrespective of a kid's background or many types of identities. They have picture books, they have history lessons, they have art projects, science projects, everything and anything that reflects their lived experiences, and also where they can learn about others in a balanced way. I think, too, it can relate to how teachers decide to, again, going back to this notion of stepping in. So when they witness something that is really uncomfortable or wrong, rather than just ignoring it, they can use that into a teachable moment, right? Where they can make a certain statement, because teachers are also leaders and they influence a lot of lives. So they can say things like, "We don't talk like that, and here's why." But rather than punishing and blaming and shaming someone who might have said something inappropriately, to make that into a moment of reconciliation, right? Because ultimately, what we want is to teach kids how to resolve conflicts diplomatically, how to respect and honor their classmates, and also how they can not just get along, but they can also step in. Because when they grow up and they're like us, old people, they will have that critical consciousness. And this is part of culturally transmitted knowledge. We want this to carry on for generations. And so there's a great role that education does play in addressing racism. And one final thing I'll say about that too, is it does come from the top. So school superintendents and school principals, right? They have a really important role in setting the stage and also empowering teachers to do this work. And also just setting the culture to where these types of open and respectful conversations can happen. There's really a lot at stake when you think about it, in terms of what goes on in the classrooms and on the playgrounds and on the school buses and in the school cafeterias. And so we also want to encourage and empower kids to also be teachers throughout their lives, right? They can step in. They can also have their own teachable moments.
What's up, everyone? This is Dr. Paolo Laragno coming at you from the University of Washington Tacoma Counseling and Psychological Services Office. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was asked to reflect on my experiences with running, particularly during this time of stay at home, shelter in place, with everything going on. And you know, a couple of weeks later, you know, after everything that happened and everything that came to light with the Ahmaud Arbery case and his murder, and I was asked to kind of reflect on that, because I had spoken a little bit on race and representation in running. And yeah, so after a lot of reflection, the first thing I want to mention is I don't feel like I can accurately speak on that, or at least maybe accurately is the wrong word. I don't feel like I'm essentially the most qualified person to speak on that experience, even though I can share my emotional reactions and some of my own things that I've done. Like, even though Ahmaud Arbery and I share some similarities, both being non-white male runners, like there are a lot of differences too. I don't identify as Black or African American. I'm a Filipino man. And even though, you know, I've had some experiences involving race while running, like my experiences are very different, and I will get into that. So given that, I wanted to encourage anyone listening, all of y'all listening, and those who are putting this podcast together to you know, seek out those voices, seek out the voices of Black, African, and African American runners, and see what is that like? What has their experience been like? And not only after everything has come to light with this case, but just in general, you know, what their experience is like, you know, because, you know, I've heard things where, oh, like running should be, and this is something that I'll get into a little bit later, but this idea that, oh, running should be for everybody. Running should be a safe activity for everyone. And this is clearly displayed that it's not. So yeah, I would recommend, you know, seeking out, and not just to get experience, not just to hear stories about the fears and the dangers of running as a Black African-American person, but also just every part of that experience. So my initial reaction to hearing about the Ahmaud Arbery case and everything and his murder was just, you know, fear, sadness, outrage, and thinking, wow, like I and so many other people take safety for granted at times. I know for me, I'll be honest, like I've been harassed while running, but it's a different experience and I'll get into that, but I've never feared for my life. I've never been running to the point and felt like, oh, like what, you know, these people here, what are they going to do to me? Or someone could just sneak up to me and attack me. Like I've never felt that. And so I have a lot of privilege in that case. Now, parts of my identity being Filipino and everything like that, being Asian, like it's one of those things where, you know, when I've been harassed, it's often because the perception from what I've received is that I'm an easy target. So the majority of the harassment I face has been around either people thinking I don't understand English, which is a ridiculous, you know, racist thing to do and say, or just teasing and things like that around race, around things like that, around my race. And I think it's based on that. It's at least for me, it's based on a perceived or on a perception that I wouldn't speak up or that I wouldn't talk back or that I wouldn't like stand up for myself, which it often surprises people when I do. You know, during the times, you know, and I'll say, you know, this isn't a terribly uncommon experience, but again, it's not something where I feel like I'm being perceived as dangerous or as a threat. So because of that reason, I don't feel like there's any threat to my life or any threat to my safety, really, other than harassment and maybe, you know, maybe some threats to my safety, but very little, nothing where I'm feeling like I'm a dangerous person that needs to be dealt with. And so I can't honestly speak to that experience. And, you know, given that, you know, it made me think, you know, when I, you know, a lot of folks, you know, even though folks who don't run did like the run with Maud on Friday, which would have been his birthday. And when I remember going through that run and feeling just so overwhelmed by all these different emotions, like one being like, he should be running right now. He should be alive. He should be enjoying a birthday run, you know, the same as the rest of us are running. And the other thought was, wow, it's hard for me to imagine what it would be like taking every single step while running and thinking, could someone attack me right now? Could someone try to end my life? And, you know, going back to my reflections that I had originally recorded for this podcast, I thought, would I have the same relationship with running if that were the case? I don't know, probably not. And so I just invite, you know, whoever's listening to this, everyone who's listening to this, just reflect on that. You know, no matter what your identity is, and you may have that similar experience. But if you actually, you know, if you're thinking about this, think, what can I do? Because I'm trying to think of that now. Like my perspective with this case is less so of, well, let me try to highlight my narrative, even though, you know, I did want to share that with y'all. My role that I see in this case is more of that of an ally, more of that of trying to provide that support, finding different ways to challenge these norms and these stereotypes in the running community, you know, and in running in general, because, you know, that, you know, even though some people might say, oh, it's a far stretch to say that lack of representation at the start of a marathon is directly related to Ahmaud Arbery's murder. But at the same time, you know, it's one of those things where that same mentality of like, oh, like there aren't a lot of Black people that run recreationally. That same thought that someone might have may lead to that same suspicion that may lead to that, that combined with the narratives, the general social narratives and implicit biases around Black people being dangerous, it'll lead to things like Ahmaud Arbery's murder. So just invite y'all to think about that. I don't really have anything else for y'all. I feel like talking about running and race is such a rich discussion. There's so much that can be said about it. And so I actually, you know, invite us to talk more about that at some point. But I don't really want to take up more of this time to do that. So I'm going to end my reflection here. Again, urge you all to, you know, seek out other voices, Black African-American voices, when it comes to their experience of running. And again, not only around, you know, Ahmaud Arbery's murder as a Black runner, but just experiences running while Black, running while African-American in general. So with that, I hope you all have a good day, good evening, and peace out.
My name is Melissa. Everyone knows me as Melly, and I'm currently a senior. I'll be graduating this spring, and I'm actually doing a lot. I'm double majoring in business management and global studies with a minor in Spanish. I'm the co-president for the AFORPZU, the Asian Pacific Islander Student Union, and I am the marketing assistant at Career Development on campus.
Well, my name is Joe. My title is not nearly as grand. I'm a junior. I'm pursuing information technology. I am a PZU's treasurer.
I've seen on social media, whoever you could say perceive, like, looks Asian, like, they've been attacked on social media. Like, I've seen it on social media, and it's just like, I don't know. It's just like, it's really heartbreaking, as well as just seeing how, like, how far people would actually just go and just like start, like, you know, going up to you and just saying, get out of here, get out of America, or just get out, like, you should die. Like, you know, it's just, it's very like, why would you tell someone like these kind of things?
This pandemic, it brings out, you know, it brings out the best and the worst people. But if I would see the worst making news coverage, I mean, you got the toilet paper scalpers, sanitizer scalpers, insert whatever, commodity scalpers. You have people trying to rename the virus to Wuhan virus, which is, huh? Yeah. And as Melly said, just as long as you don't look like them, it's like, it's that kind of virus. It's, if your eyes look a certain way, then you're going to get the blame for it. I remember Professor Andy was telling about businesses in West Seattle that are, you know, Asian American owned, are being vandalized because of this whole pandemic thing. So you have to wonder, when's the next stage of violence? You know, will it get worse? Hopefully, you know, I want to believe it won't, but, you know, who knows how this will all play out.
I just feel very uncomfortable being outside now. Like, it's just like I remember there was I think it was like a few weeks ago, but like my boyfriend and I were out getting groceries, and you know, it's spring, it's allergy season, and my boyfriend has allergies, so he starts sneezing, and like, you know, people were staring at him, and I like looking at him, and I was just like, it was just like a fear of like, you know, just a fear of like, you know, people are now like looking at you just to sneeze. Like, if you need to cough or sneeze just because you have a, like a simple, like something stuck in your throat, or you just have to sneeze, it's just like people automatically like look at you like you are something else, or looking like, oh my God, like this person has it. So there also has been occasions where like we went to Walmart for groceries, and like someone went up to my boyfriend, just called him like, you're a disgrace, and like, and then walked off. And then, so it's just like, it's like, I just don't feel comfortable going outside. So it's just like, it's kind of like, it's not, to me, it's like, I'm just worried, and I just don't feel okay going outside.
I was raised in Parkland, Washington. So basically Tacoma, I've been in Tacoma for, you know, whole life. And the way I experience racism is, Twofold. So I'm a half Samoan, half Filipino. And when you mix that together, you get me, which is pretty ambiguous looking. So some form of racism that I got growing up is that I just got miscategorized and they just took it to the next level. So they looked at me, thought they already knew what I was, and then just like reached in the stereotype bag and pulled it out. I remember being at work and a customer came in and he looked at me. He's like, so you part of the Muslim Brotherhood? I was like, what? The Muslim Brotherhood? Like, first of all, second of all, third of all, like, that was all going through my head. And then, you know, how do you respond to that? No, I'm not, you know. And then it's interesting when people pull out of their asses to so quickly label you. On the other hand, when people do find out, I'm like, I say I'm Samoan, and they're like, oh. It's just like, oh. What does oh mean? I remember, specifically in terms of the education system, you know, a lot of Pacific Islanders are have a tendency to drop out and not make it past, like, to the university level. And so sometimes in certain settings where they said, oh, I'm Samoan, they're like, oh, and they already count me out in their head, like I'm about to drop out or something.
If there's a crisis or there is something like affecting like everyone that you are supposed to be that leader of, and you're supposed to be a representative, be the the voice to lead, it's just like, you don't want to be that person who's going to make you, your members or your country divided at more, because it's just like, you're supposed to be doing this all together, being finding it all together, being communal, being one with each other.
You know, it's all these different just explosive reactions to the whole virus. And it doesn't help that, you know, the highest authority in the land is encouraging this type of behavior.
It's easier to blame. It's easier to do the wrong things, and then it takes a lot of courage, empowerment, support to redirect and learn, like, from, like you say, mistakes, or like, you know, just and gain the support to people to move forward.
A lot of these reactions are born out of fear. You know, racism it's not genetic. I hope. know, babies aren't born racist, you know. Racism is taught, and, you know, it's born out of fear. So how do we teach others not to fear? You know? Mm-hmm. How do we change their world point to how do we change their worldview to, you know, to not be so warped? And I heard an interesting thing, kind of espoused by some minorities, saying that, oh, we shouldn't be like the educators, we shouldn't have to be put in these roles to educate others. And it's tiring, yeah, and I understand, but I think the unfortunate reality is that no one else is going to teach them. You know, we just have to. You know, grit our teeth, and we had to be the teacher sometimes.
How do you speak up for yourself when you are the minority, you know? And it's just like, the way I think of it, that's why it's so important, especially for our group. What we did was just like, you know, APIZU is like, we do showcase both Asian American and Pacific Islander students in our group, and we're very diverse. We have a variety of students, so it's just like, that's why it was so important for us to, you know, talk about this, because it's just like, we don't know if, even if you identify as Islander or PI, it's just like, you don't know if you'll get attacked too, you know, or like, you don't know if someone's gonna point fingers at you, or you won't know that one of your best friends or your close loved ones are getting attacked as well, as you know. So it's just like, we did the family meet to bring awareness that, you know, like learning about like our staff members' experience, but, you know, trying to come together saying this is the resources we have on campus. This is what these are topics we should be talking about. But also it's just like, you know, knowing that we are, you know, even though we are API, we are still a community within each other. You know, we are still this, we're doing this all together, you know. It really takes, to me, in my perspective, it takes a lot of, I think if I will use this word right, courage to talk about the hard stuff, you know. like it takes a lot of courage to talk about the stuff that people don't want to talk about.
Thank you to our guests, and thank you for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe. You can find us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts.